everyone. My name is Paul Koufalis. This is Gilles Quéret. Everyone is going to have to try to pronounce his name properly so that I can get a good laugh.
But then
I have some very choice English words that you could ask him to pronounce, and then everybody else will get a good laugh. And we're going to talk about high availability. Your book is bothering me.
Holy Scott.
Jeez.
I just tried to put it out of the way already once.
Yeah, you're trying to hide my name from the screen. It's terrible. We're going to talk about high availability on the databases on the app server side. Who was in our high availability workshop, on the weekend? A couple of people there. So there'll be some overlap of material, but a lot of new material too. So we're pretty informal, as you can see. So if you have a question, raise your hand or shout out. Mike Fergal is just waiting to get me back for yesterday's audit presentation, so I'm sure he'll shout out quite a bit. So we'll talk about high availability. We brought this up because last year, just before the pub challenge, the peg went down, and it's great. Greg's not a, thank God Greg never comes to the DBA sessions. So the peg was down for a little while because it's Greg, you know, these things happen. But I don't know if you could go to your boss and say, I'm sorry, production was down because there was a poker tournament, and I took a nap. But MFG Pro came back up eventually. So why are we here? I want to talk more today about high availability, more so than disaster recovery. So I want to talk about keeping the application alive rather than, you know, bringing it up after it's exploded and on the ground. Now, Progress doesn't support real application clusters or some of that other nonsense, so there are occasions where the database is going to go down, and now we're going to talk really about how can we get that database back up rapidly without pulling out, you know, the 16-inch DR plan binder, you know, where the VPs have to get involved and everything. So let's see what we can do to maintain the site in production on the main servers, keep it up for as long as possible. And not have it go down, or if it goes down, how fast can we bring it up? So we'll do a quickie intro. The way I'm gonna do my half on the databases, I'm just gonna go through 4 or 5 real life scenarios that I see all the time at my customers, and then some of the things you can do to minimize the possibility of the impact, and then Gilles will jump in and he'll talk about the app server side, all right? So it's a lot of material to cover, so we're gonna stay pretty high level. It's really just to get your brains thinking about some of the things you can do in your environments today, all right? So like I mentioned, we don't have a rack type solution, so really we're trying to minimize the possibility of database downtime, okay? So scenario one, who's ever run out of disk space somewhere? Everyone has run out of disk space somewhere. Today we often see it due to uncontrolled BI growth. So who's woken up in the morning and seen a 23 gig BI file, right? And you're running OE replication, so you can't truncate the bloody thing yet. Poor Rich Banville is sitting there. I'm gonna look at him the entire time that I'm presenting. So you can't truncate the BI online. You can't truncate the BI at all with OE replication. So of course, monitoring is the most important thing. You need to have some kind of monitoring software there. So some solutions. Well, you can ProStruct add online to try to add some extents on another file system where there's space. God knows I've seen that where the database is spread over all kinds of file systems. More in the old days when the disks were small. Today, you can buy these terabyte disks, so we're not running out of disk space as much as we used to. I also advocate, much to the chagrin of many of my other DBA friends, I advocate one file system for the DB and the BI and the AI. In some very large instances, you know, large transactional throughput customers will segregate some of that out if needed. But for most of my customers that are 100, 200, 300 concurrent users, you know, the databases are 50, 100, 150 gigs. We're putting everything on one file system. There's really no reason to say, oh my God, my DB or my BI file system, which was 9 gigs, because I thought that was amply big, is running out of space while /DB has 400 gigs free. So if today you've still got kind of the old thinking from 10 years ago where we're segregating everything out, go back to yourself and say, why am I doing this? Is it because of AI? Because I said, oh, I need to be able to recuperate those AI files to apply them to my DR. You know, we used to say we could take the hot swap disk out that has the AI files and run to our DR box and plug the hot swap disk right back in and recuperate those AI files. Today, most of the times, we really can't do that. Things are on SANs or the data centers are far apart. You can't really do that today. So if you've got segregated file systems, really convince yourself that you really, really need them. Otherwise, I would say probably 99% of you don't need them. All right? Scenario number two is index corruption. Again, same one, who's seen this error message? Thank you. I know I'm going to ask, but you're all going to say it's great, because usually people don't raise their hands when you ask questions. I don't think we see it very, very, very often. I don't see it as frequently as I used to. You know, a lot of the problems that caused this have pretty much gone away over time, but we still see it occasionally. Today you can index fix a lot of this stuff online. I'm not saying you can index fix everything, but if you're not aware of the online index fix command in modern versions of Progress, I don't know if this is like a 10.1c-ish kind of 10.1b solution, but you can index fix a lot of stuff online today. So there are impacts on production, right? You will lock tables, records, so be aware of that. But if the difference, I mean, if it's that or shut down the database and do an index rebuild for 2 hours, this is probably the least impacting solution for index fix, for an index problem. All right? Do I have to ask who's hit a lock table overflow? Thank you very much. You need to fix the offending process. We all know that you need to fix the offending process. You've got to find out who is the user who's locking 97,000 records in the database. There's one guy usually. Occasionally it's really 10, 20 processes that happen to be doing a lot of stuff at the same time. But usually it's a programmer who screwed up and you're locking the entire database. So you need to find and fix the process, but you've also got a lot of screaming users because they're trying to lock one record and they can't, because they keep overflowing the lock table. So let me patch the problem temporarily, and then so people can work, and then let me go ahead and actually fix the problem by killing the offending user. And that's the good old increase to parameter. So you can increase to a whole bunch of parameters online, like the minus L. So hey, you're at 50,000, increase it to 75,000. It's not gonna take a lot of memory. It'll let the people keep working, and then, correct me if I'm wrong, we're about 40-something bytes now, I think, per lock table entry.
I think it's like 84, but...
84? Okay. Yeah. Sorry, I'm a little old in my information. 84 bytes or so. But even that is insignificant, I think. You're just hoping that you don't have to add a new shared memory segment, because if you have shared memory clients, there could be some permissions issues about trying to add a shared memory segment to the database. But mostly, you should be able to get away with turning them on. Some other stuff like minus B and minus BI buffs, you can also do online. But those are more performance related, rather than really stopping your database from functioning the way a lock table overflow will do to your users. Oh, and there's no way to decrease any of this stuff online. So once you've increased them, they're increased. And you can only decrease them when you shut the database and restart with your whatever your natural PF file is for the database. Okay. Bad client-server parameters. This is another one I see regularly. People don't quite understand these max users, max servers per brokers, max connections, and max servers. There's always, every time I talk to clients about it, they kind of understand them, but not 100%. So just to be clear, this is max servers for all the servers. So this is minus MN is the kind of the highest level one. It goes on the primary broker when you start your database. And that says, I don't care how many secondary brokers you're going to want to start, but the sum total of all the secondary brokers and the servers that they're going to spawn, it better fit in my minus MN. Otherwise, I'm not going to be able to spawn them. All right? I like to tell people, be liberal with this number if you can. And minus N, another one people think minus N is the number of users, and so they think they need to match the minus N to the licenses that they purchased. This is not necessarily true, because licensing doesn't have anything to do necessarily with connections. So set your minus n to the number of connections you think you're going to have, remembering that a user might connect 2, 3, 4, 5 times to the database. So don't be worried about increasing minus n, but figure out how are you going to properly calculate the number of licenses you're consuming. All right? And when you're deploying in client server, well, each broker, so let's say every minus capital S listening port, that's a broker, a listening broker, and he's going to support up to minus MPB times minus MA actual users on that broker. So the maximum servers for that broker times the maximum clients per server on that broker will give you the maximum number of users that that broker can support. And again, I've seen this all the time. I see this mostly when people enable SQL in their database. And so they just enable it on the same port as the primary broker, and then the SQL servers are spawned and they start taking server slots on the primary broker. So they think they have, you know, 10 servers times 5 users, they can support 50 4GL client server clients, but then they spawn 3 SQL servers, and that's 3 times 5, 15 less ABL clients that you can support. So the first lesson for this is segregate all your login brokers, right? So you have one for SQL, one or more for ABL, depending on the architecture of your application. Another one I've seen often is where an application takes 2 connections per user. So I've seen people who are refactoring their application to do OE reference architecture. So part of the application connects directly to the database and part of the application goes through the app servers. And so they have 2 actual connections to the database. And I've actually seen where they're spawning 1 app server agent per user for a stateful agent. So there's really 2 physical connections into the database. So then we add 100 users, and in this client's case, we added 400 users, you know, and well, they didn't set the minus n and all the minus mn's and the blah, blah, blahs correctly. So when they topped on those 400 users, only a couple of hundred of them were really able to connect into the application. So we had to go in and increase all those parameters after the fact, which was not good, a little perturbing to production to turn everything off so that we can increase them. And another thing I saw recently at a client, they were using some third-party web SQL blah, 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 BI thing, I don't know what. And so they installed the agent process on the Linux box, and it talks to the web BI process. And every time they turned it off, it spawned 10 SQL connections. But because they hadn't actually done anything in terms of segregating the servers and the brokers, well, it would spawn, you know, 3, 4, 5 SQL servers for the 10 SQL connections, and then the poor ABL users couldn't connect. And then to make it worse, their bloody software, I don't even remember what it was called, when it finished what it was doing, it wouldn't disconnect. So you had to physically go in and either kill the processes or disconnect the users from the database. So the users can't connect, and they're like, oh, but our stuff is stopped. Well, you're still connected to the database. No, no, that's not possible. Here, Netstat says that I'm still connected to you, so... Anyways, solutions. Segregate all your login brokers. Some people like to do this where for the primary broker, they don't even put the minus capital S on the primary broker. The primary broker is only for shared memory connections, and they really start separate secondary login brokers for ABL and SQL and power users and whatnot and wherefore. So
everyone
there are some...
should do that.
Sorry?
Everyone should do that.
So you see, we have a lot of...
I agree.
Bigwigs here who are advocating this...
Well, one of the reasons that's nice is because then you can kill those brokers and it doesn't...
Kill the database.
Yeah, it doesn't mess up shared memory.
Exactly, exactly. So this is what we're pretty much deploying all the time now, is the shared memory primary broker and then the segregated client server brokers. The only time we don't do that is, I guess, for clients that don't really do client server connections, or they might pop up the minus S because occasionally a developer connects into the database, but they're not actually using client server in production, for example. I tell people to leave plenty of overhead space in minus N and minus MN. So when you do your calculations, I'm going to have 100 users, and I want 5 users per server, so I need 20 servers. So minus MN should be 20 plus those secondary. I need 22, and they set minus MN to 22. No, set minus MN to 30. It's not really costing you anything more. A few bits and bytes more memory because there's more entries in the server table in shared memory. But if you're in the crap, sorry, and you need to start another broker for whatever reason, at least you've got a little bit of space there in the server table. So I always round up to 30 to 40, add a dozen, add 10 more. There's no license cost, there's very little memory cost. You'll probably never need it, but if you do need it, you're gonna be happy it's there. Same thing with minus N. If you really need 100 users, set it to, 150. So you're gonna need a little more semaphores, a little more this, a little more that, but at the end of the day, the cost to add 50 more users is this, versus the cost of the one time you're going to need those 50 more users, and you need to shut down the database to add them. So be very generous with these numbers. And then if progress auditing comes and audits you, you can say, no, that's not what I'm doing. So.
All right. It's Paul's fault.
It's Paul's fault. It's always Paul's fault anyways. I'm married now. It's always my fault. So you can't increase MPB or MA online, but you can add our third or fourth broker. So I've seen situations where we'll take the app servers, we'll change the connection PF on the app server agents to connect to my new broker, and then we'll just trim, we'll just keep trimming actively until they all disconnect from the primary broker, and then they'll go connect to this new broker, and maybe I liberated 20 or 30 slots or whatever on my primary ABL connections. Yeah?
One other thing too, each of those brokers should have its own PF file.
Absolutely right. Each of those brokers should have his own PF file. And the way I do it is there's always, the primary broker for me is always db.pf, and then anything after that is db.somethingelse.pf.
Yep.
And the reason I do that is if you do a loop in KSH where you say for PF file in ls of star.pf, it's always gonna grab that primary one first, and then, so you know he's gonna run that one first, and then he'll run all the secondary ones. The other thing I advocate when you're using PF files like Gus suggested is don't put the minus M3 in the PF file. So I want to, when I do a PS, I want to see underscore mproserve minus M3 minus PF database.sql.pf so I can easily grep those secondary login brokers. So you grep out the M1s, which are the automatic brokers for the ABL, and then you grep out the M3 brokers if you're just looking for the primary brokers. So put the M3 parameters outside the PF. All right. So a lot of solutions there, but if you architect it like this and you end up in this situation, you're not in a situation where you need to shut the database down, and that's the key thing here in terms of deploying. All right. Who has ever heard the hard drive death rattle? So now you've got the hard drive death rattle. You know your server is imminent death. My other favorite one is the air conditioning in the computer room is dying, and you see the temperature going dook, 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 and then you see the door to the computer room is open, and there's fans blowing air into the air. Who has done this? Everyone has seen this, and you know that when that number hits like 42, 45 degrees Celsius, 100 degrees Fahrenheit, things are going to start being unhappy really, really quickly, you know? Or maybe you're just running Windows, so you're on imminent crash at some point anyway.
But there's a cure for that.
There is a cure for that. Apply the Linux patch to your Windows box. I probably just put this in for the anti-Windows people in the room everywhere.
That's true.
So we don't have any rack-like functionality. I don't really think we need it. I don't know. I wouldn't. Nobody asked for it when we have all the database talks or the please beg for your favorite feature talks like we had yesterday.
The info exchanges.
Thank you, the info exchanges. Please, please, please let me. So we don't have any rack-like functionality. So But we don't have a high availability solution. We are going to bring the database down. It's going to come down. Prepare for it. You are going to die. You know, but at least you know, and you should be prepared so that you can be reincarnated very quickly somewhere else. All right? So you can do pro cluster enable. I don't know anybody who uses pro clustering. Are any of your customers using clustering? So
not many, but yeah.
I don't want to discuss this now, but I would love to hear someone tell me the advantages of pro cluster enable versus just doing your own poor man's clustering. But
the hardware economics have changed so much, it's not worth it anymore.
Thank you very much. The hardware economics. Did someone record the hardware? So we really don't see pro cluster enable. So we'll do poor man's clustering. We'll have the same kind of thing where it's a shared SAN for the database. And so if the production box crashes, we'll do our own clustering. We'll bring another box up. We'll import those file systems, the same DB file system from the SAN, and then we'll continue. So we were down, but hopefully we were only down for X number of minutes. So we did our own kind of clustering without having all the heartbeat and the clustering software built in. Poor man's clustering. But you're dead now. We're trying to minimize the pain. And we don't want to have to go to Denver with our DR box. Everything's running fine over here, hopefully. Maybe it's just the box that's dying. OE replication. So I'm sure a lot of you do this, where we implement OE replication with two targets, a local target and a remote target. Usually we'll use the local target for reporting, but that local target could be used for DR also. So you don't want to activate the DR plan again, where production goes to another site and there's costs and there's complications involved with that. Maybe you can fail over to your local replicated copy first, rather than activate the whole DR plan to go to your Houston, Denver, whatever you're doing for your DR. All right, small DNS change, and then everybody knows that the database is running on the other box. All right, poor man's replication, which is basically the same thing, where you can keep a hot spare database on another box and just keep roll forwarding AI files locally and remotely. So same thing, you can just keep them there, and then if you need to fail over to a box, again, it could be a local box, so you don't perturb all your network connections, you don't overload that line going to your other site, all right? And then server maintenance. So you just need to do maintenance on your production box. Really, it's very similar to the previous scenario where you know your production server is going to be dead imminently, but you can plan for it. So you can fail over to your local OE replication target, bring your production over there, again, fairly easily with very minimal downtime, and then fail back to your production box after you did your server maintenance. So maybe during that time, if the other box is smaller or whatever, you'll have reduced performance, but if you time it properly, if you have enough advanced warning, then you can still survive on that box and then fail back to your normal production box before everybody comes back to work on Monday morning, for example. But you were at least not down very much. So quick questions for me before we jump to Jill. Mike? So
how many people are testing with failover? I mean, we struggle with our customers because they have all these elaborate plans, and then they won't fail over.
Correct. So, you know,
and we just had one guy last Wednesday do a full-blown failover test. They planned for this for 2 weeks, and the failover test failed.
Yeah.
You know, so testing your failover plan is a non-trivial event.
So I would think, Rob, your customers, I hope, test their failover plans.
Yeah.
You have to say yes anyways.
Annual or semi-annual.
So my customers in the banking industry, they do test. In manufacturing, they never test their failover plan in manufacturing. I have never seen a QAD client test his DR plan.
That's because nothing's going to go wrong.
That's because nothing's right.
So ours was a QAD customer, and like I said, planned for 2 weeks, went through it, and the thing that failed was firewall access. It wasn't the database, but there's just so many components to this.
Yeah. And typically when I do see customers in the banking sector test their DR plan, guarantee the first two are going to fail until they get it right. And then 6 months later, okay, what did we learn? We learned this, we fixed this. We're trying to keep abreast of all the things that have changed in the past 6 months. And then we do it again. And finally, you start getting it right, whereas, okay, when you run it every 6 months or every year, you might hit little things, but if it happened in the real life, you can recover from the little things fairly quickly. Firewall stuff sometimes is very hard to recover from because you don't know. It's blocked, right? And then the firewall guy's grepping through the logs for you and they're not very nice because they always get blamed for everything, the firewall guys, right? So when you tell them it's a firewall issue, he's like, yeah, it's always a firewall issue. So
we found, we did the pilot test on a wholesale distribution customer. Mm-hmm. And they were running replication. Failover went okay, but restoring back to production is where
the failed battle.
With replication, it's not easy to, when you've got a large database, to reestablish your...
Well, it is easy if you set it up right. It's very easy to do, but if you set it up wrong and you brought 300 gigs back across the network, and then you say transition and it didn't work, then it's not so nice anymore. So, but that's why you're testing failover and fail back. And if you came to my lab on Sunday when I did the open edge replication lab, you'll see that I advocate very strongly that in the transition stanza and the replication property files that you put the very, very minimum, parameters. I want the transition process to do the least amount of work possible, which really all I wanted to do is enable AI and reverse the transition. That's it, stop all the other start primary broker parameters, start secondary broker parameters, blah, blah, this, all that I never, ever, ever use. Just enable AI because I have to enable AI for it to be a source database, do my transition, stop. And then after that, I'll take over to start my databases, do my connections, and all the other stuff. So I strongly advocate that. Do the bare minimum in your replication properties files in terms of the transition stanza. Other questions? All right, so that was a half presentation. And now Jill is going to come in and talk to you about the application side of the process. Let me bring up the other PPT. Okay.
Excellent. So, welcome everybody. My name is Gilles Carreca. I assume almost nobody from in this audience will be able to pronounce my name correctly. So I will take the opportunity to pronounce badly English names because I have a strong French accent. So if you don't understand something, let me repeat, rephrase, whatever. So in this presentation, we will talk about high availability with app servers. So Paul covered the database stuff. This session will be only about name servers and app server, high availability and load balancing, and the different options you have to achieve high availability. So first point, who's using app servers? Okay, so no need to explain what is an app server. So we will cover only stateless and state-free app servers in this session. And by the way, state reset and state aware are deprecated. I don't think there are any more customers running state aware, state reset. Anybody running? Okay, only one. So first, let's have a look at the name server. So the name server is a Java process which is managed by the admin service. A name server lets you register app server brokers by an application service name. And so when a client wants to execute some business logic on an app server, it will do a request onto the name server, ask for a service name, and the name server will return the app server broker, host, and port number. Name server only work using UDP. There is no TCP at this level. So for stateless app servers, agents, so where the business logic is executed, agents are not dedicated to a client connection. So I've done some netstat I've been running Netstat to see exactly what was going on when an app server broker registered to a NIM server, and when a client connection requests a service name from a NIM server. So the client connects to the NIM server, which will provide the address of the broker from the list, which is managed on the NIM server side. Then the client will invoke an app server request. The broker passes the request to any available agent. Agent executes the request and returns the result to the broker, which is then passed to the client. And when the client no longer requires a connection, it disconnects from the broker. In a step-free model, there is a slight difference in the way connection is done. When the client connects to the NIM server, the NIM server will return a list of app server brokers instead of just a single app server name. So when the client will execute request onto the app servers, they will be done on any agent in this list which has been returned by the NIM server. So one of the points is connect and disconnect. Within your application are required to update the list and make sure that your request will be done on different agents and in different app server brokers. So if your application doesn't do any disconnect, it will always try to connect to the same broker. So stateless or state-free, if you're a DBA or sysadmin, this is not your code. Application has to be developed differently when working with stateless and state-free. So application developers will tell you, I need a stateless or a state-free app server in my context. Web services require state-free. I need slightly easier to maintain context when you work with a stateless app server. Also, this can be done also on state-free app servers. A simple setup. So, a very simple use case. NIM server listening on a given port, 5162, which is a default port for NIM servers. App server broker, let's call it AS1. It will listen on 3090 TCP, and when it registers onto the NIM server, it will say, hey, I'm AS1, I want to register as an accounting service. So an entry will be added onto the NIM server list, the NIM server services list, and the NIM server will be able to manage as many services as you want. So we can register a second app server. An app server can also register under multiple names. So this one can register under finance and marketing. And then we have two different entries on the NIM server services list. So this is register under multiple name is also useful when you want either, for example, when you want to merge different app servers or you want to split them, because a client always requests a service name. And so if you have two service names at one stage that are being executed on two different app servers, you can merge the app server, register under two different names without changing any configuration on the client side. Oops. So the NIM server, what is being done when a client executes a query? The OpenAI Java adopted client will send a UDP frame to the NIM server and say, hey, I'm looking for an app for a service name for finance. NIM server will locate finance in the services list and return a UDP frame back to the client and say, you can find one at this IP address and port number. NIM server neighborhood. So any NIM server can have neighbors sitting on the same machine. So when a client goes for a NIM server and asks for any service, if the NIM server doesn't know this service, it will ask different NEM servers to retrieve, to look for this service name and return the answer. So we can work also with remote NEM server. So a remote NEM server is just a configuration option in uboker.properties to say that there is a NEM server sitting on a different machine at this IP address and port number. So it's not a real process. There is nothing to execute on this server. It's just a configuration entry. You can use that with NEM server neighbors so that requests can be forwarded to different servers. So a NEM server, you will tell him that I have a neighbor, which is in fact a remote NEM server, and so the request will be passed to the next server, physical server. So here we have a NEM server NS. You declare a neighbor, which is remote NEM server, add a configuration entry in uboker.properties, saying that the remote NEM server is on 10.0.0.11 port 5163. This is located on a different physical server, and app server brokers register on different names. So two different app server registering on server 1 and server 2. So when an OpenEdge Java or .NET client is looking for application service name finance, it can go directly to the first NEM server. The first one will say, okay, there is no match. I don't know for service name finance. So the request is forwarded to remote NEM server, and which is not a real NEM server. So that will be forwarded to NS2F, which will say, okay, I know an application service name finance, so I will tell you that you can execute, you can connect to this app server broker sitting at 10.0.0.11. One use case can be to have a kind of proxy NEM server. So you have a very, very light physical server running NEM servers. We can just tell every request to be forwarded to different NEM servers. And so you can restart easily this proxy server, or just change the name or DNS resolution for this server and switch to a different one. And a request can be forwarded to whatever server you want to use. This can be done so without changing any configuration on the client side. NEM server load balancing. So multiple app servers can register under a single service name. So when you register, you add a priority weight to your configuration, and the NEM server will take care of doing a sum of every priority weight for a given service name and do the dispatch according to the to every app server register under the same service name and according to the different priority weights. You need an additional license, NEM server load balancing license, to have multiple app server register as the same name and be able to put priority weight. This may be quite expensive, especially if you consider the number of lines of code which have to be added to implement that. So the first app server broker, IS1, say, okay, I'm accounting, I have a weight of 10. So we only have a first entry, only one entry on for this service name, so the priority weight is 100% for this broker. When the second one registers, it says, hello, I'm also accounting, and I have a priority weight of 30. Yeah. So here, the name server knows about two different brokers. It does 30 plus 10, this is 40. Okay, so the first one will get 25% of the calls, and the second one will get 75% of the calls. So when a OpenApp Java or .NET client is looking for a accounting service name, this is located in the services list, and the UDP form back to the client will say in 25% of cases I will tell you to get this App Server broker, and in 75% I will let you go to the second broker. So use case, you can do that during server upgrade. For example, you can just say that a given App Server broker will be given a priority weight of 0, or you can stop it completely here. So the name server will be aware that, okay, there is one less App Server broker in my services list. I will dispatch every week of request to the second broker. So you can do your upgrade on the first server, then bring back the App Server broker, register with a priority weight, and then you do the same thing with the second broker. So request will be dispatched only to the second one, and then only to the first one, and then back again to the two different App Server brokers. Something you can also do is, you can do some UDP broadcast. Next servers have to listen on the same port on a given VLAN. So you send a UDP broadcast on 5162, for example, and every name server will get a request, so they will all answer back to the client, but the client will only take care of the first request. So it's usually the closest server to your location which will say, okay, you can go to this App Server broker. And in case the first one doesn't answer, there will maybe multiple ones being able to answer something. And so you can have a name server done or a complete server done. Other servers on the same VLAN will be able to provide you an App Server broker list to execute your business logic. This can also be done during when you register an App Server. So in this case, you can define a remote name server in your broker properties, and says the remote host is on the 255 broadcast address. So your stateless and state-free App Server, you tell them to register on NS broadcast. So when they register, they will say this name server that, hello, I am accounting service. This will tell everybody on the, this will broadcast registration, so this name server will get the service name, and the second name server will also get a request on move that there is an App Server sitting on this server, which is able to execute accounting business logic. And so on the second server, you also register on a broadcast. So SF1 will be registered on NS1, the secondary server, and on primary server. So you can do that during registration, and also when you execute client code, and when you want to connect to name server. So the Java OpenEdge or .NET client can send UDP broadcast frame saying, I want to connect to an accounting app server. So it may be either name server here on this machine or here on this machine, and it will only deal with the first answer. Be careful, UDP broadcast, this may be, there may be some restrictions on UDP broadcast in your networks. So it may not cross buildings, it may not cross different networks. So you have to be on the same VLAN in order to make sure that you will get an answer from Unicrypt broadcast. So be aware that this is not, this may not be useful in an internet scenario. For example, during the workshop on Sunday, it was impossible to execute this kind of UDP broadcast on EC2 instances because EC2 doesn't route UDP broadcasts. So this is limited to your machine. So not available in every scenario. So this is different ways to what you can do with high availability and a load balancing. So you will have to test those few different possibilities, make sure this can fit your environment, and do some tests. This is the same as with disaster recovery on HA for database. You have to test it and verify that the network won't be a problem. You also have to make sure that your application is written correctly. One of the problems is the connect-disconnect. Some applications just will connect at the beginning when they start the application, and just disconnect at the end. So it will be extremely difficult to have some load balancing and high availability in this scenario. Any questions?
Yeah. Have you heard, we've had issues with named servers just pulling over.
Can you speak a bit louder,
yeah,
please?
We've had issues where, particularly on the Windows-based servers, where the name server stopped working for the Unix things, and it seems to be a...
You had problems with name server?
Name servers, yeah.
Yeah, I never had problems with the name server. I consider it pretty stable. There are sometimes problems with app server brokers where you get out of memory problems. And sometimes the broker is kind of stuck. So it keeps accepting connection but doesn't pass a request to agents. So you have to, you can kill the app server broker. And by the way, there is a ping pong mechanism between the name server and app server broker, so that if they don't answer in a certain amount of time, the service list will be updated and say, okay, this app server broker doesn't seem to work anymore, so I will remove it from the list. But in the meantime, some request will be passed to this app server broker, so your application may get a failure. Your application also have to be resilient to bad connection. It may happen. So some application just crash and say, I'm not able to execute on this app server, we go back to the login page. They don't handle correctly the situation. So you, even in high availability scenario, you may still get some bad response from app servers and NAT servers, so you have to handle that and say, okay, I wasn't able to process your request, try again in a few, in some moments, and execute it again.
Yeah, we've seen times where we get java.lang. Out of memory errors in the app server brokers, but the way I understand it, it's multi-threaded, so the thread in the broker that's talking to the name server is still pinging away very happily, but the thread that actually does any work is dead in the water, and so you literally have to go and kill the broker yourself because the name server says he's still there, so even he's still happily with your load balancing sending some requests in that way. So you do have to keep monitoring your app server brokers. You can't always rely on that, and like Jill said, you really need to have your code resilient to occasional failures.
So you need to connect out the broker of these memory allocations to the app server broker.
Yeah.
It depends.
If there is a MEMA with each, by the way, it would just grow and grow and grow. Yeah. And I think, as far as I know, there are still some problems in some cases, even with 11.3.2, there are some cases where MEMA with just
We also tell our clients, when we deploy app servers, especially when it's stateless or state-free, and so with stateless and state-free, the data is going from the agent back to the broker, through the broker to the client, and sometimes that agent generated a big fat chunk of data that needs to swallow its way through. And so what we've done is we've enabled on the JVM, it's a verbose GC on some older versions of Java or XX verbose, blah, blah, blah. And we actually log the Java heap and the garbage collecting. And then you'll see over time that even with garbage collecting, the heap size keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And once we hit some threshold value, we start alerting to tell the administrator, okay, you need to bounce this broker. So then we can go in, if we need to, if it's quiet, we can just kill the broker and restart it. Or if it's busy, we can drop the wait to zero. Requests will stop going to that broker, they'll go to the other broker, then we can bounce him happily, not affecting anybody, and then when we bring him back up, well then the Java heap is clean again. So a lot of times what we'll do is we'll deploy, say this is all production, you know, if it's not a monstrous environment where I really need two apps, I don't need to load balance my app servers for performance reasons, so I'll have my database and my app servers on the same box, so that the app server agents can collect and connect in shared memory to the database, but we'll still load balance to the other side, but we'll put a weight of zero on the other side, so they're really just there in case this guy's not answering anymore. So it's a highly available app server as opposed to really a load balancing app server. So we retain that shared memory performance here rather than doing a client server performance like this.
So it's using what the proposed option to figure out, but it's to chew through memory.
Yes, and we'll do that. We do that on all the app server brokers everywhere. They're always running, and then there's some little bash file or whatever, some script that's just chewing the log file and saying, "Oh, you know, you're at 800 megs. You should know about this." And we see it going up slowly and slowly and slowly over time, where the garbage collector is not releasing memory, and then we know, okay, it's safer. Once we hit that top number, we know we're going to get a Java Lang out of memory error.
As you said during the workshop, NEM server load balancing can also be used in order to buy really cheap servers instead of buying a huge server with loads and loads of memory and CPU. You can use NEM server load balancing to buy 10 bits of boxes, pile them up in your data center, and just do a load balancing between those 10 servers. And it may be cheaper than having to pay lots of maintenance and buying this kind of hardware. Questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.